Genealogies are boring. Okay, somebody said it. All right, somebody broke the ice, okay? Genealogies are what? Finish that sentence for me. We said honest answers. Okay, all right. Interesting. Necessary. Old. Is that what you said? What else? Unpronounceable. Yeah. Good one. What's that? Details. Long. Yeah, family history. One of the words I was thinking of was tedious, right? Revealing sometimes, yeah. So I want to give you another way of thinking about them here tonight, and that is to think about them in terms like this. Genealogies are the stories of people's lives. Right? Think about that. Every name that's listed, while it might be hard to pronounce or tedious or boring or old or all of the things that are there, all the genealogies mentioned in the scriptures are here for a reason. I know sometimes it's easy to read some parts of scripture and you're like, I know why God put it in there. He needed to convince everybody that they're sinners and show everyone that Jesus is the Savior, right? We understand why that's in there. But sometimes, if we're honest, right, you read through the genealogies and you ask yourself, was this really necessary? Right, is this fulfilling a purpose? And the answer, of course, is yes. But just think about it in terms of this, that every single person's name that's inscribed in the Bible is there because it's a story of an actual person's life, just like you. And just like me, right? And even more than that, I mean, as we think about this in the first five books of the Bible, Moses wrote all of this down because God specifically told him to write it all down. Right? There's a reason that God said to Moses, and how would you like to be Moses, okay? You're dictating the story of Genesis, you're dictating the story of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob, right? And then God says, okay, now here we go. And he starts listing off this big, long list of names, and so-and-so we got so-and-so, and so-and-so we got so-and-so. I mean, do you think that would get confusing as he's writing it down? How do you spell that, God? there's a lot of questions that come there as you think about these genealogies that are here. Now, a lot of these genealogies include people's names that you'll never see anywhere else in the rest of the Bible. But it's helpful for us to think about the fact that these are the stories of real people's lives. The few people that we do have lives of that are included in these genealogies are of note, and we need to pay attention to them. And sometimes that's one of the very best reasons for us to read them, is because there will be a mention of a name, and there will be a mention of a tidbit of information about them, and that can really be helpful for us in understanding our world in which we live. Now, you might think that that's saying too much, but the whole entirety of chapter 10 that we're going to be looking at tonight in Genesis is the story of how we have the first 70 nations of the world in which we live in still to this day. You think about like the nations. I know there's about 180 different countries or so that are recognized right now, depending on who you talk to. This chapter before us here chronicles where did the first 70 nations come from after everything was destroyed by the flood. So it's an enormous testimony to how the earth was populated and to the direction or from where they all came from. This is really the generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. It's really what this chapter is all about. And many people, for that reason, because of all the nations included, call it a table of nations. If you want to think of it like a spreadsheet or a chart that has, you know, Shem, Ham, Japheth, and all the people that came out of them. It's a table, right, of all the nations that came from them. And so we're going to take a look at this here tonight. Now, we're going to do this in a couple different ways. One, we're going to kind of just observe some broad observations of the whole chapter, okay? The second thing we're going to do is we're going to look at one guy in particular whose name is Nimrod, who's mentioned here, and then we'll talk about some of the theological trajectories that come out of this thing. I'm not going to read every single name here tonight, but I will reference them in sort of chunks, and if you want to go back and read them all out loud or read them to yourself, feel free to do that. But if you notice here in chapter 10, verse 1 is where we'll begin. Some broad observations here about this genealogy. Chapter 10 begins with this new generations of. If you've been with us through this study, you know this phrase here, these are the generations of, is a sectional divider in the book of Genesis. It's broken down by this. It's called Toledot is the Hebrew word here. And there's these sections of Genesis that are broken down into these are the generations of. And then a bit of a story or a tale about their life, right? Or a genealogy. And then these are the generations of. And then the story of their life. And these are the generations of. And it's kind of giving us the main figures to get from Adam to Abraham. And then Abraham's main heirs from there to the nation of Israel being established after they get into Egypt. And so these generations of, are the sort of sectional headings that are in Genesis that God gave Moses and that we follow. So this section begins, this is the genealogy, or this is the sort of generational markers or details about Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Noah's boys, right? You know that Noah and Mrs. Noah were on the boat, they survived, and then Shem, Ham, and Japheth and their wives were on the boat and they survived, right? Everybody else, what happened to them? They died, right? So how did the world repopulate? And that's what this chapter is all about and where they came from. Again, as I said, this chapter is often called the Table of Nations because it gives us the first 70 nations of the world listed off of based off the lineage of Noah's three boys that are here. And what we're really going to see here, and I'll show you a map here when we get done with the generalities of this, is that essentially the Shem, Ham, and Japheth account for people in Africa, Asia, and Europe. And you think about that, that's pretty much everywhere. That's the origins of population of our entire globe, right? So these guys are going to be divided up into those three regions of the world, and from them essentially comes the progeny of the entire world from them. All right, so this is thinking about, like, how did the world populate itself after the flood? That answers that question. And also, how did people get to certain places on the world? Chapter 10 here does not follow the pattern like we saw back in chapter 5 or chapter 11 that we'll see here in just a bit. Because if you remember back, that was so-and-so begot so-and-so at such and such an age, and they had sons and daughters, and they lived so many years after they begot that child, and the total number of years that they lived was such and such. There was a formula back in chapter 5 where we hear about Methuselah, the guy who's 969 years old, and right, all those details. This doesn't follow that kind of a formula. It's more focused on who was born, not when they were born or how old they were, but who came from Shem, Ham, and Japheth. If you look carefully here, if you look at verse 5 and 20 and 31, you'll also notice that it says, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations. Okay, so there's this separation within Shem's descendants and Japheth and Ham, within their descendants, they were broken down by language, families, and nations as they were separated across the earth. Now, should pause for a minute and say, when were they separated? Right? When were the people of the world separated? You tell me. Tower of Babel, right? Have we studied the Tower of Babel yet? No, we haven't, because it's later on, it's in the next chapter, in chapter 11. So this generational section, this dividing here, tells us how Shem and Ham and Japheth filled the world, but it doesn't tell us how they filled the world yet. That's going to come in chapter 11, but it assumes that it's already happened, right? Because every group, and just look at 5 and 20 and 31, those verses here in this chapter, they all talks about how they are divided up and how they're separated based on language and families and nations, okay? It's looking back. It already knows that Babel will take place, and it's looking back and saying this is where they came from, okay? And they divided themselves up in their regions based upon three categories: their language, their family, and then there's this individual matter of nations, okay? So this is giving us a kind of a large picture at everything that is happening here. If you were to look in 1 Chronicles chapter 1, which was another look at Israel's history that traced the post-exile Israel all the way back to Adam, this genealogy basically is there too. And apart from a couple of spelling differences, it's almost exactly the same. Right, so you can think, and the reason they did that after they were exiled in 1 Chronicles was so that they could sort of regain their national heritage and reestablish land and all different other things. So they had this genealogy that was maintained all the way into the post-exile years. And it's amazing the consistency. It's really a testimony to how God takes care of his word, how God can take care of these details of family lineage and family heritage. And God has done this for many, many years, and that's for a reason. Now, the reason that there's also something else you should note here is that these sons, whenever we talk about them, it's because the way they're listed using the scripture is Shem and Ham and Japheth, right? We always say Shem, Ham, Japheth, Shem, Ham, Japheth, and that's because it comes out of there. But if you look here at the text starting in verse 2, you notice that the genealogy goes Japheth, Ham, Shem. It changes the order of it. Now, why would they do that? Why would they change the order? Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is we're told that Japheth is going to be older than some of the other boys. And we're also, the most important reason is this, is because Shem is the most important of the three mentioned. When we talk about Shem, Ham, and Japheth, that's usually because we put the most important one at the end. But the way this genealogy is arranged, that it does Japheth and then Ham and then Shem. Now, why is Shem the most important? Well, the simple answer is because Abraham came from him. That's the answer why. Okay, Shem is going to be the ancestor of Abraham, and you know that Abraham's a pretty big deal when it comes to the nation of Israel, right? So when we say Shem, Ham, and Japheth, he's always given the priority in this whole matter, but here in the genealogy, it kind of goes from least to most important. Okay, and that's kind of the way that it works here. So let's talk about a couple of the sons that are the descendants here. First of all, in verses 2 through 5, you'll see the sons of Japheth. He receives very little attention in this scripture and only has 4 verses. 6 of his sons are made mention of, and 2 of his sons are given a further entry, Gomer and Javan. Now, the sons of Jovan will have a huge impact in the rest of history, and you might be able to figure out why. If you look there at the end of verse 5, these people, from these coastland peoples of the Gentiles, they were separated into their lands. Essentially, what you have here in this descendants of Javan is, if you imagine the Mediterranean Sea, okay, you know, you've got Israel right here, and then you've got, you know, Greece and Italy and Spain all across the northern part. Essentially, all of the peoples that filled that whole entire quadrant, they all come from Japheth. Now, you and I should kind of care about that, because looking around the room here, how many of us have some sort of European heritage? Right? Somewhere down the line, right? Somewhere from that region of Europe. From some place along that whole place is probably where all of our descendants came from, which should kind of be like, where do we come from? Which seems most obvious that we come from Japheth. Okay, so that, imagine all the coastland areas. And one of the cities mentioned particularly is, one of the boys' name is Tarshish. You've heard that name before. It's probably this coast town somewhere off the, almost all the way the other end of the Mediterranean in the country of what we would call Spain today. So imagine that whole entire swath all the way along the western side of the Mediterranean, or eastern side rather, and then all the way along the north and all the coastlands. Think about that. You've got Thessalonica, you've got Greece, you've got Rome, you've got Spain, and all of that swath, all of that came from these descendants. Okay, so that's what I say in terms of world history, even though they're not given a huge amount of emphasis here, you and I think about it, that's really our heritage. Okay, as we think about those people that came from that region. Moses adds here a summary about Ham's descendants, or about their descendants here, that they were the coastland Gentiles and they were grouped by these matters. One of the questions that comes up here, and I'm not going to answer it right now, but is to notice here that already from verse 5 of chapter 10, that you've got coastland people, and they're specifically called Gentiles already. Why are they called Gentiles? That's the question I'm not going to answer yet, okay? But you should be noticing there's already this distinction between Gentiles and somebody else, okay? And they're already being labeled as such. And it really begs the question, what makes a person a Gentile? What makes them a Gentile? You and I think of Gentiles as being non-Jews. So how is it that they're called Gentiles already? And what is the distinction given to them? So you can chew on that for a few minutes and we'll come back to it a little bit later. Second son that's mentioned here then is Ham, the son of Ham. Now, you remember what Ham did? Anybody remember? What'd he do? Uncovered his father's nakedness, right? And so he was cursed, and his descendants were cursed, and specifically his fourthborn, whose name was Canaan, he was cursed, and that they were always going to be servants of their other brother. So we're to Ham. What's going to happen to Ham after the curse that he was, that he faced? Now, on him, the sons of Ham are some of the foundations of the mightiest nations in the whole entire world. If you look there at verse 6, you see the sons of Ham were Cush, Merizim, Put, and Canaan. Now, those 4 nations right there constitute some of the most profoundly powerful and influential nations in the entire world. And you're like, what? I don't recognize any of those names, really. They don't really ring a bell to any of, they don't really ring a bell to me. But let me go through and tell you who they are. Cush was settled in the area south of Egypt and became the home of the Nubians. Anybody ever heard of the Nubians? If you imagine where Egypt is in the country of Africa and go south, there was a whole nation called Nubia, and they were mightier than Egypt for most of world history. So most people think about Egypt being a mighty nation for a lot of years, for generations upon generations. There's all these epics of pharaohs and leaders in Egypt. Well, the Nubians were even more powerful, but they were in the southern part of south of Egypt. Merizim is a word that normally gets translated Egypt. We know about Egypt, right? know about the history of Egypt and its power across most of the entire Old Testament world as we think of it. Okay? Egypt was a mighty and powerful nation. Put is in northern Africa, where Libya is today, and Canaan, you know all about Canaan. Again, if you look back in world history, you'll find out that northern Africa and the region of Libya was incredibly powerful throughout the ages of the history of the world. And if you were to look back at some of the early church fathers like Augustine and others, North Africa was a mighty place of learning and of power. And that comes from Ham here. And also, you know all about the people of Canaan, because you've read about them in all the stories that the Bible teaches, right? All those peoples, all the ites, right, that filled the land of Canaan, they all come from Ham. Now, what's fascinating here as you think about this then is that the sons and the further descendants of Ham had incredible power. If you look at the ancient world, you might think about Greece and Rome being very powerful. You might think about Persia or Syria or Babylon. A couple of those are from Ham's descendants. But if you think even back a little bit further than that, all these countries in the northern part of Africa and up into the Mesopotamia region, which we call Canaan today, those were basically the world superpowers for generations of world history. And who did they come from? They came from the guy who was supposed to be the servant of everybody else, according to the prophecy that Noah gave. Right? Think about that. So it should make us scratch our heads here a little bit in thinking about this. Even though he was cursed, he had 11 sons who would fill and control a massive part of the region that God inhabited here at this point in the world. It's very clear that in the first generations of life, Canaan and his sons would not be the servants of anyone. It wasn't until later that they became the servants of Japheth and Shem. But God is not slack on his promises. Even if at first the power was with these boys, and we'll talk about one of the reasons that that was, eventually God's promise through Noah was fulfilled, and these people became servants of everyone else around them. Many of the nations represented here in the line of Ham were thorns in the side of Israel for lots and lots of years. You know about this. I mean, just think about the stories of Judges and all the ites that came after him and all the trouble that Joshua and the people had when they first went into the land the first time around. You think about the constant threat of Egypt. And even though Egypt had held them in captivity, Israel was always like, let's go back to Egypt, they'll help us. Right? There was always this trouble, and this is always going back to the descendants of Ham. From Mirzam came Egypt, the people that would place them in bondage and continue to tempt them away from God. The Philistines also came from Mirzim's son. There's all these different peoples that were like sort of the main antagonists to Israel, all come from the line of Ham, and they're started to make mention of here. Now in verse 19, if you look down there at the end here, or towards the middle of this chapter, you see that their land borders are given here as well, and this is important. The border of the Canaanites, okay, so we're talking about a specific part of Ham's descendants. The Canaanites were dispersed, obviously post Babel. And the border was from Sidon as you go to Gerar, as far as Gaza. And then as you go to Sodom and Gomorrah, those cities sound familiar to you? And then Adma and Zeboim as far as Lasha. And these were the sons of Ham according to their families, and it's described there as well. These cities are some of the wickedest cities that we know about in the Bible. Right? Sodom and Gomorrah? Nice place to settle down with a family, right? No, right? Not at all. But where did these cities come from? They came from the descendants of Canaan. They came from the descendants of Ham that are made mention of here. Now, you might not recognize the cities that are called Adma and Zeboim that are mentioned right after it. But actually, if you look forward in Genesis chapter 14, there's five cities that were all in a valley. You had Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, and Zeboim, and then Zoar. And those five cities constituted this sort of valley of wickedness, essentially. And this is where Lot got himself in all that trouble, if you might remember there. And the place that they went to escape, God told them to go through the angel. He said, go to Zoar. That's where Lot and his daughters escaped to. But the other four cities were all destroyed because of their wickedness was parallel. So these two cities, even though they're not like Sodom and Gomorrah, like we throw those terms out and everybody knows what you're talking about, these two cities, Adma and Zeboim, were thrown in the same sentence. And they actually become referenced in Deuteronomy chapter 23 and also in Hosea chapter 11, where God says specifically, how can I give you up? He's speaking of his affections towards Israel and says, how can I give you up and destroy you like Adma and Zeboim? So he looks back on this and says, these cities are incredibly important for us to think about. We'll find these four cities again in chapter 14 of Genesis when we get there, because old man Abraham goes to war. Remember that story? Lot gets captured, and so Abraham gets a bunch of his guys, and they go. There's five nations battling with each other, and Abraham's like, we got this. We'll go take them all out. And they did, actually. So imagine old man Abraham and his 300 guys going in after five armies, and they rescue them, and we'll meet these cities again because they'll be there right in the midst of it. And in that same place is when he meets that mysterious priest called Melchizedek, which is a huge, like, Christ picture in the Old Testament. So these cities that are made mention of here will appear again a couple of different times in our studies in Genesis. Now, the sons of Ham, it says here also, were divided, and they were spread out here across this region that is there. Now, there's one other person in his family that we'll come back to, and his name's Nimrod, and we'll come back there. But first, let's talk about the sons of Shem. They are mentioned last here, starting in verse 21 and following, because they are the most important. A couple of them are highlighted specifically. You've got Eber, who's mentioned there in verse 21, and then you also have, because Eber had two sons. One's name was Peleg, and the other was Joktan. Now, Peleg just kind of gets put to the side. Okay, he's going to get this whole discussion in chapter 11 because from Peleg comes Abraham. So he just gets set aside, and Joktan is the one who gets made mention of here, and he's the one who is spoken about the most here. Shem had five sons, but Moses goes directly to Eber, and from there he focuses on Joktan. The other brother, as I said, is set aside. If you notice here in the middle of all, it says in verse 25, to Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, and in his days the earth was what? Divided. Okay? Again, here we're talking. This is looking back and saying it was between and during the days of these two brothers that the earth was divided. And so we get the genealogy of one now, and the other one is divided, and we'll talk about him later. Not only in sort of rhetorical effect, but also getting to the point of what God did through Babel, which is coming up here in the moment. These boys lived through the scattering of the nations and were sent out into the Arabian Peninsula, okay? And the reason that we talk about Semites, probably heard that term, maybe you've probably heard it in this context, anti-Semitism, right, really comes from the word Shem. They're Semites. So whenever we talk about anti-Semitism, we're talking about this hatred towards a certain group of people that descend from Shem, anti-Semites, okay? So that's helpful in thinking this. Now, Brett, you got that next slide up there? This generally, then, is how this all settles out. Again, if you were to trace out all the cities and all the land and stuff that are here in this chapter, this is basically where it works out. You've got Ham's descendants in that northern Africa region. You've got Shem and what we would call the Arabian Peninsula, Asia Minor into Asia. And then you've got Japheth up there in the European section, okay, which I say why it matters to us. But essentially, look at that right there. That is why we call the Middle East the cradle of the world. Because where did all of humanity come from? It came from right there. Right? It came from this region. We recognize this, and that's not only the cradle of the world because it's the center place of where Judaism was founded and where Christ did all of his work on the cross, but there really is the beginning point of humanity on the world today as we know it. So these three boys that came off of the ark, you can see they filled Asia, Africa, and Europe. And this is where their descendants went in this trajectory. And from there, then the rest of the world was populated. Okay? So I think that's helpful in sort of seeing how this all worked out. Now let's go back to chapter 10 and verse 8 and talk about this guy named Nimrod. Anybody ever called someone else Nimrod? Right? It's one of those names, I don't know if it gets thrown out on playgrounds anymore, but it used to be a name that was kind of a derogatory term, like, hey, you're such a Nimrod or something, right? It was a name that you would sort of, you know, banter with each other on the playgrounds about. And he is made mention of here, and he gets more attention than any figure in this whole genealogy section, which is kind of interesting because he's not a good example. Why Nimrod? Why does he get four verses worth of material, and we're not talking about somebody like Abraham or something, who will eventually come down the line? Why Nimrod? So that's the second part. If you look at verses 8 through 12, see, Cush begot Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And then listen to this. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Erech, Akkad, Calneh, and the land of Shinar. And from that land he went to Assyria, and he built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Calah, Rezin, between Nineveh and Calah. That is the principal city. Some of those names you recognize, I would imagine. You probably recognize Assyria and Babel and Nineveh, and you may recognize Rezin too, depending on how up you are on your world history. Think about this man then and what is said. Nimrod is much like Cain's heir Lamech. You might remember him. He's the guy who was bragging to all of his girls that he had about how he had killed a guy just for the fun of it. You might remember him. Nimrod is sort of established himself by force here too. He's the son of Cush, which makes clear here that he, and it says in verse 8, that he began to be a mighty one on the earth. Now what that means then essentially is this. There was a time when people coexisted together on the earth, sharing the load of humanity. But when he was around, and when he began to sort of flex his muscles, if you will, what it means here is that he began to take things by force. That idea of him being a mighty one is not the fact that he's stronger than everybody else, that he was like a Goliath figure or something. The indication here of him being a mighty one, and really the way that this word gets used, is talking about the fact that he began to impose his will upon other people. He began to use force and strength to use his abilities then to sway people. Prior to this, there was not a formal jockeying for position. He became the first mighty one on the earth. Now again, that's probably reflective of what's happening post-flood, because before the flood, this probably was going on too. But he was sort of the first of the new generation on the earth that became a mighty one. He established himself through this might, or you could probably say it, I think this is a fair way to paraphrase this, that Nimrod became the first tyrant on the earth. I think it's a fair way of describing it. Nimrod here is described in verse 9 as a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, without the account of Babel, you might not say that's a bad thing, right? Somebody is a mighty hunter, especially in our region, people are like, good job, right? There's something to be praised about that kind of thing. Like, oh, you can kill an animal with a bow and arrow. Good job. I mean, there's some praise. Now, I know not everybody feels that way, right? But if somebody is a successful hunter, you usually have some measure of respect for them just because of the time and labor and skill that goes into that, right? But when you start to think about Nimrod, wow. When you start to think about him in this phrase, Nimrod like a mighty hunter before the Lord, again, at face value, that doesn't really seem to be a negative thing. You and I think, like, successful, he's a successful hunter, or he does well at what he's doing. But when you think about what Nimrod built and what he used to strengthen power for, it becomes apparent that this was not something that was to be praised. Nimrod built a city that stood opposed to God. Nimrod built a city and nations that defied God to his face. And so the proverb that developed, like a mighty hunter before the Lord, is not something that is a positive thing. So I'm sorry if, like, in your boy's or your grandson's bedroom, if you put like a mighty hunter before the Lord, you might want to reconsider that, okay? You might want to reconsider this, because the whole legacy of him being a mighty hunter is not something that is positive. Is probably being described as talking about hunting animals or hunting game. It's the same word used to describe Esau. However, it's also used in other places to describe those that are ruthless and skillful as military leaders. And while this may seem like, oh, hunters, yes, I like hunters, it may actually be pointing to the fact, especially when you consider the legacy of the cities that he built and the heritage that was established on the things that he built in terms of his kingdom, that's what this might actually be saying, and I think probably more accurately, is not that he was a mighty hunter, but that he was a ruthless warlord, essentially. Okay, this man was not anything that was to be praised. This becomes clearer as we think about this. And again, the phrase itself doesn't just say, oh, he was a ruthless warlord. But when you look at the legacy of what he built and the trajectory of what he started right here and how God dealt with it in chapter 11 and then how it's going to impact the rest of the world history, you realize the direction that Nimrod built these kingdoms towards. And if you look again back at the text, the beginning of his kingdom, verse 10. The beginning of his kingdom was what? Babel. Now just stop and think about that, right? Again, this is why I say, you might say, well, a mighty hunter for the Lord, I don't see why that's so bad. But the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Does that clarify the issue for us? It should begin to help us understand that the beginning of what he was trying to do, the beginning of his kingdom that he was trying to establish, was the city called Babel that we'll take a look at next week, or not next week, but in 2 weeks. This city that stood in opposition to who God was. We'll get to the story of Babel, but essentially the story of Babel was God told them to keep expanding, and they said, no, we're going to stop right here. We're going to establish ourselves a city right here. That was Nimrod's doing. Right? He said, I'm going to make a kingdom for myself right here so that nobody can come against me, so that nobody can attack me, so that nobody can move me. I'm going to establish myself right here. It was essentially anti-God in what he was doing. Like, God, if you want to move me, you move me because I'm putting myself right here. And you know what God did eventually, right? But this is the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom. He's not building God's kingdom. He's not building the nation of Israel. He's building his own kingdom. And his own kingdom is started with the city that we know as Babel. Essentially, what he's doing here is establishing his own name, establishing his own rule. And his intentions were not to build a better human society, but to build his kingdom. Now, what do you know about people that try to establish their own kingdoms in opposition to God's kingdom? Never works. Bad news, right? Look at some of the other people, some of the other cities that he established. Babel was a failure. So what did he do after that? Well, he established the land of Assyria. And what city did he put there? Nineveh, it says in the text, right? We know a little bit about Nineveh. The whole book of Jonah is devoted to it. Nineveh is constantly a place of wickedness. And you have Rezin between Nineveh and Calah. And Calah and Rezin were also mighty cities in those days that the Assyrians used to establish wickedness across that part of the world. Nimrod said, Babel wasn't enough, so I'll go make Nineveh. And I'll go make Calah. And I'll go make Rezin. His legacy and what he was building were cities that were known for wickedness, for idolatry, and opposition to who God is. And that DNA of the cities continued for years and years and years, so they became more and more wicked as time went on. And they also became more powerful as time went on for a good number of years. Now consider this. Who were the two of the most wicked and mighty nations in Israel's history? They were Assyria and Babylon. Now I know there's other bad ones. But when you think about some of the worst, some of the worst that they had to deal with, Assyria and Babylon, writ. And both of these nations were founded on the bedrock of Nimrod's kingdom. Babel becomes the Babylon, as we call it today. And Nineveh became the capital city of Assyria down the road. This man's built his kingdom, and it lasted despite their wicked character. There's another figure like Nimrod a lot of years later that lives in the same region, and his name's Nebuchadnezzar. Remember him? This is the part of the reason I asked the question. What happens when a person tries to establish their own kingdom in opposition to who God is? And Bonnie said, it doesn't go well. Remember Nebuchadnezzar? He tried to establish himself as the ruler of the world. He tried to establish himself as the thing that all people were supposed to praise. And what did God do to him? Put him out to pasture, right? He turned him into like a wild beast, and he spent a long time out in the wilderness until he finally repented, and God brought him back, and he made laws saying, God is the one who is to be praised, right? But here again, this is the legacy of Nimrod. Generations and generations and generations later, the same attitude, the same DNA was within the people of Ham and within the generations of Nimrod that continued to follow. And so these cities and all the things that came out of them, this is just one of Ham's descendants, Nimrod, was a particular thorn in the flesh of many people for many years. And I would remind you, when people try to set up their own kingdoms, even still to this day, in opposition to who God is, it never works. That's why we're taught as Christians to pray, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Because when we try to do our own will and our own ways and live in opposition to the kingdom of God, we're always going to fail. If you need another example, ask Satan how it went trying to stand against the kingdom of God. He was defeated and put to open shame by the Lord Jesus Christ on the cross. Now, a couple of theological things to walk away with this from. First of all, if you're still jotting some notes down here with me, some theological impact. The first one is this, is I hope that you can see the folly of what Nimrod set out to do. I hope you can see the folly of what he set out to do. When people decide to raise up their own kingdom in the face of the Lord, danger and doom are close ahead. Now, I know that most of us probably aren't setting out to try to establish our own kingdom on the world, right? We're not trying to, you know, take over the world and entire state of Michigan to make it our claim. We're not trying to take over all of the UP and we're going to stick a flag it and say land of Shaw or something, right? I know people aren't trying to do that, but we functionally operate a lot of days like kingdom builders because we say what I care about, what I want is what matters more than what anyone else in the whole entire world wants. I'm ruling me and I'm ruling everything around me. Do we live that a lot of days? If we're honest with ourselves, we do. Right? It's not about anything else other than what I want and how I want to rule. And that is a very dangerous way for us to live. Nimrod's example of his life really is categorized and really best illustrated in the Tower of Babel that he set out to build. I'm gonna establish myself right here, and God said, no way. Because that is what happens when we try to build our own lives around our own agendas and our own power and make our mission to be, I'll put myself at the center of everything and I will be the ruling authority in every part of my life. When we do that, we are in real trouble. Again, we might not be after world domination, but when our main priorities are me and my rule and my independence and my self-rule versus thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, we are on the same treacherous path as Nimrod and Nebuchadnezzar. It might seem like I'm overstating that, but give it some thought. Whenever we try to establish our kingdom and our rule in opposition to God's rule, it never goes well. Think carefully about that. A second thing that we see here in terms of theological lessons and trajectories from this is that there's absolutely no biblical basis for racism. None. Why? Because we all come from the same three brothers. Or you could say, we all come from the same dad, right? And again, we're at this bottleneck in world history where we're talking about Noah and his family. I know it goes even back further than that we're made in the image and likeness of God. We're all from Adam. I realize that. But at this bottleneck where everything was destroyed and then everything was recreated, right? At that point right there, we're all family. There's absolutely no basis for racism whatsoever because we literally all originate from the same family. Now, within that same family, are there different cultures? Yeah. Here in the text, they're even referred to. Are there different skin types? Are there different languages? Are there different ruling parts of people? Yeah, there are.